ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Bill Novelli. He's currently a distinguished professor of the practice at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business, where he started and oversees the Business for Impact Center. He's the co-founder of Porter Novelli, a global PR agency that was one of the first social marketing companies. Previously, he was CEO of AARP, president of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, and COO of Care USA. He's also the author of the new book, Good Business, the Talk, Fight, Win Way to Change the World, which is the focus of our conversation today. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You've had such an interesting career, and the beauty of your book is that your personal career, your inspirational journey and experience provides a wonderful behind-the-scenes look at how policy is crafted and how business, advocacy, and governmental agencies come together, that messy, complex process that delivers positive progress. And almost every chapter could sustain its own interview. So, because we only have a limited amount of time, I'm going to jump around a bit and ask you about some of the thematic elements that I picked up when I was reading. So to set the stage, you didn't spring from Zeus's head with this vision of this thing called social marketing. You started your career at Unilever, learning by working sales on the job, and then you moved to the agency side and worked for WRG. And it was while you were there that you had the epiphany that changed your life. Can you share what that was?
Yes, I can. I was at Unilever, as you say, as a brand manager, and then I went to the agency side, and I was doing well in both cases. But I was working on consumer products, laundry detergents and kids' cereals and what have you. And at the end of the day, I would always say to myself, I can't really find any social relevance here. And it was something that I was I was yearning for. And then one day I got a new account assignment from the ad agency, and it was public television. And public television was trying to build audience, and it was the first time they'd hired an agency. And my first assignment was to go to a press conference. And the press conference was being conducted by a woman named Joan Gantz Cooney. And she said, "We're here today to tell you how we're going to revolutionize children's learning through television." And of course, it was Sesame Street that she was introducing. Mm. I sat there and I listened to her, and I thought to myself, she's an educator, yes, but I really thought she was a marketing person. And this light bulb went on in my head, and I must say it was a revelation. And it really was that I could take the same marketing principles that I was applying to packaged goods, and I could apply them to issues and events and causes and the kinds of things that she was doing. And so I set out really to try to figure out how to do that and how to make that into a career.
So interesting. So this is really the genesis of your big idea and really your North Star going forward. It's been and continues to be a through line. Is that fair?
It is fair, but I can't say it was a straight line or a linear line. I jumped around a bit. And Gabrielle, I have students who come to me and say, I'm graduating with my MBA. What's the pathway to success? Mm. And of course, we all laugh at that kind of thing. And what I say is, There is no path. There are many pathways, and you have to discover your own. But that's part of the joy of it.
It's funny you should say that, because I was going to say, putting on my devil's advocate hat, you mention in your book that in your course, you sometimes get provocative with your students and use excerpts from Jeff Chrysler's satire, Get Rich Cheating, The Crooked Path to Easy Street. And so why not cheat? What's wrong with the budding Gordon geckos and the greed is good mantra? What do you say if people, take that point of view?
Well, I have a really hard time selling the idea of cheating. These students, you know, I do it in a provocative way, as you said. It is, the book is a satire, of course.
Right.
And I assign it as a reading. And the students, that you know, they are just so adamantly opposed to it. But one day I was doing a an online class, and I had this Chinese student in the class, and I was trying to sell cheating in a provocative way, as you said. But of course, what I was really selling was the idea that we have to be ethical. Mm-hmm. This student said, she left the room and she came back to this Zoom call, and she had a baby, an infant on her lap. And she said, "This is why I don't cheat." I thought it was powerful.
Yeah, yeah. Nothing like children and animals to help really send a point home, right? So you've sold me on working for good. In the book, you often say at your core is that you're a marketing guy. And do you think that actually, if we boil down human behavior, we're all marketing guys, identity signaling to our tribes? This is who I am. This is what I believe. This is what our group needs to know, do, be aware of to survive.
I do think that way. I think marketing is a really powerful discipline. And I think that we can apply it to so many different things, as we were saying earlier. The thing about marketing, the lesson I learned, though, is, you know, when you're a marketing professional, you think about your marketing mix and you think about changing the behavior of your target audience. Mm-hmm. But a lesson I learned was that's not enough. Hmm. And that if you're really going to create social change, you've really got to create, you've got to change social norms. You got to make it normative behavior to get your blood pressure checked, to stop smoking, not to drink to excess, to think about climate change, whatever it may be. And the fastest way to change normative behavior or expectations, I think, is policy. And when we talk about marketing, we don't really think about public policy. And so I've added that to my, you know, to my quiver, if you will. That's another arrow in the quiver.
Right. Right. Well, it's interesting if we think about the marketing piece of it, and that there's an element of universality that readers can relate to in their own life. One of the things that that you mentioned in your book that you don't think is innate is leadership. And why is that? I mean, because if we think about, you know, you're marshaling change and then policy change, but you don't think that leadership is something that just is inherent in everybody. What is that? Why is that?
Well, I think that lots of people are born with leadership skill, not skills, but traits.
Uh-huh.
So I'm thinking, you know, Winston Churchill.
Right.
FDR, whomever. Mm-hmm. But what I always think is that that's not enough, and that you can actually make yourself into a leader. Mm. And it's partly your character, of course. It's partly what you learn and know, your competencies. It's partly your commitment. And you can develop those kinds of things. So if you don't think you're a great leader, or you're in the middle of the ranks, you want to go up in the world, I think you can really improve upon your leadership skills. I feel like, you know, that's something that we can all learn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things you talk about in your book in relation to leadership is the role that leaders have in shaping culture, and how it relates to bringing purpose to organizations. And can you expand a little bit on that?
Yeah, I think that changing organizational culture is one of the hardest things to do. Mm-hmm. So, somebody once said that a good definition of culture is the way we do things around here.
Right.
And if you're in a big organization, it's hard to change culture. I've tried.
Well, and that's interesting, because, you know, it also goes to, can you lead if you're a subordinate? Can you, if you're a subordinate in an organization, and ultimately everybody's a subordinate except at the very tippy top, can you lead? Is that something you can do?
I firmly believe that you can. I learned that from Colin Powell.
Okay.
One of the things he liked to say was, you can lead from the middle. And I see that all the time.
Can you give a a story, a little
yeah,
example?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people in the middle are building teams. They're working across teams. You know, they're influencing the organization every day in their way. It could be a small way or a big way. So the idea of leading from the middle, as Colin Powell used to say, was, you know, you may not have the title, you may not have the, you know, the job function, but you can be a leader. And I like to practice that. I like to tell my students that. I like to talk to corporate people about that, because that's how change happens.
That's such good advice. So good. One of my favorite lines from your book is, problems worthy of attack prove their worth by attacking back. Can you explain what that means and give an example?
Well, I call it, I don't know, you can call it a mantra or a war cry or whatever you wish. But the idea here is that today's social and environmental and economic problems do attack us back. They're big and they're tough and they're almost intractable. And you know, it's because of that, we can't have constant warfare among the different sectors between government and civil society and the corporate world. We need to work together. And that's why the book title is includes the words talk and fight to win. Mm. And I believe that you need to get everybody at the table.
Right.
There are no permanent enemies. There are only permanent principles and permanent values.
Oh, that's very good.
You know, you can have a, you know, somebody who's your opponent on Tuesday can be your ally on Thursday. And that's the way we have to think.
Right. In order to get anything done, anything accomplished.
Yes.
A strategic technique that you developed when your firm was engaged to help combat blood pressure was something you called stressing the system. Can you explain what that approach is?
That was a valuable lesson, and I learned it early in my social change career. So the National High Blood Pressure Education Program was run by the government out of NIH, National mm-hmm. Institutes of Health. And there were a lot of different kinds of partners in there. And the guy who ran it was a young cardiologist. I mean, he didn't know anything about social marketing or any kind of marketing. Mm-hmm. And he had these three committees. One was an education for the public, and one was for doctors and so forth. And so the physician committee came back and they said, OK, we get it. High blood pressure is a serious problem. We can do something about it. The medications are being developed. So we're going to take 10 years and we're going to educate the physician community. And then you can tell the public. And the cardiologist said, the hell
everybody
with that.
Everybody will die in the meantime.
Exactly. He said, the hell with that. He said, we're going to educate everybody at the same time. We're going to stress the system. And to me, that was really an important lesson. And I've always tried to apply that in any kind of behavior change program. We've got to stress the system.
Is it always a good idea? I mean, I think of work situations that I've been on in where there's a desire to make it perfect and then move it out there. Is it always a good idea to go out and you know, all constituencies all at once?
Well, I don't know if you want to go to all constituencies all at once, but you know, when people are comfortable, it's really hard to make change.
Uh-huh.
And so whenever you're uncomfortable, you've got a better shot at it. So an example is when I was the CEO of AARP. So AARP's got about 40 million members. I mean, it's a big operation. And people were comfortable. And I was trying to think of myself, how can I jolt this organization? And one day, the New York Times carried a story. And it was a story about how this guy was good. This guy had a lot of money. He had made it in the market. And he announced he was going to create a new AARP, and he was going to make us obsolete.
Huh.
And so I said, good, we're going to stress the system. And so I called my my team together. This was the top 50 managers in the organization. And I said, are we going to let this guy make us obsolete? And of course, the rallying cry was no. And so we set upon a way to reinvent ourselves. And it was a way to stress the system.
Interesting. That's interesting. And it's also interesting, your comment about discomfort making it easy for change. And I'm curious what you think of 2020 and a year of pandemic and lockdown and societal willingness for change. Are we in perhaps one of the most change possible societal windows right now?
Well, Gabrielle, I really think we are.
Right.
I think change is afoot in so many, many different ways. I mean, you know, the world is changing around us. If you look at the oil and gas industry, look what's happening to them.
Right. I mean,
they're losing billions of dollars. The climate change situation is changing all around them. They've got to change. Other companies are looking at the same thing.
Right.
You know, people are worried about COVID. We just did a study at Georgetown of millennials and Gen Z people during the time of COVID. And there is a young population there that's really worried.
They've already been one of the most anxious generations, and, you know, millennials and Gen Z vis-a-vis all the other generations. And so you take this already very anxious group of individuals and put them in a pressure cooker.
And that's exactly right. And they're worried. They're losing jobs. Young women are leaving the workforce because they don't have any child care. As you say,
it's the world, she session that's happening. Yes,
yeah, that's right. That's right. And so things are changing very rapidly. And, you know, we have to say to ourselves and look at politics. I mean, we're in this toxic mess right now.
Well, and that goes to your business about no permanent enemies, and really that you have policy positions and that you need to work. And it's sort of in some ways an old school, you know, how do we split the baby without splitting the baby kind of thing.
Right.
You know, thinking. So stress the system is almost like a strategic approach. And one thing you mentioned, and this was something I found really fantastic and very interesting, was that the tactic when you were dealing with the tobacco company executives and the idea of shaming the executives directly, the "Does your mother know what you're doing" campaign, and that it wasn't effective. And one of the things I was curious about in regard to that was, do you think it was the campaign that wasn't effective? I mean, you've worked in advertising and know some campaigns hit, some campaigns don't. Or is it that shame failed, that pro-good is more effective than anti-bad?
That's a really good question. I think it's very hard to use fear to motivate change. And I think it's really hard to use shame to motivate change. But it's also contextual. So that was back, you know, that was back in the days of when I was fighting the tobacco wars.
Right.
And what I tried to do there was, I knew the public, I had the data showing that the public really hated the tobacco industry.
Right.
But the question is, did they hate individuals, executives in the tobacco industry? So I developed this campaign and I tested it qualitatively. And it was called, "Does Your Mother Know What You're Doing?" And I would take an executive from the tobacco industry, and I was using real people. You know, a woman who was a regular churchgoer, had three children. She was working in the tobacco industry, and the only problem was she was killing people. Huh. So I presented this
campaign. A little problem there, yeah.
A little problem, yeah. And I presented this campaign, and people were very uncomfortable. And what I concluded from that was they may dislike the industry, but they didn't feel comfortable shaming individuals in the industry.
Well, right. I suppose that's the desire to separate one's employment from oneself. That, you know, it takes a lot to, you know, to say I am my job. And when people get to that point, that's where you have employees, let's say at Facebook, saying we are not comfortable with this happening and we are going to lobby Facebook to change this policy, or Twitter, because we just had this thing happen at the Capitol and so we want change to happen. But it takes a lot for the employees to do it.
Yeah. And I think also with your point about shame, you know, it may be that if you shame an industry or shame a segment or a sector anonymously, maybe that would work. So an example again is tobacco. Several years later, there was this thing called the Truth Campaign.
I was just thinking the Truth Campaign, yeah, right. Yeah.
So the idea there was, you know, young people were smoking at high levels back then. And what do young kids like to do? They like to rebel against their mothers, their coaches, their rabbis, their teachers, you name it. They like to rebel. And so the idea of the campaign was, well, let's make them rebel against those suits who are selling them tobacco, who are making them into replacement smokers. And so the Truth Campaign was really to have them attack the industry because the industry was working against them. And that actually worked.
Right. Right. Well, I think it's interesting what you said about shame and fear not motivating change. And I think it's sort of about human behavior, and change is frightening. And so if you actually, you can deploy fear if you want to stop change, that's how that tool works, perhaps.
Yeah, perhaps it does. I mean, if look at COVID right now. You know, to say to people, if you don't get this vaccination, you're going to get COVID and you're going to die. I mean, you know, fear arousal doesn't work well because people have two choices. They can either turn off your message or they can change their behavior.
Right.
Which do we think they're going to do? They're going to turn you off.
Right.
But in other cases, it seems like it has worked. So we need to do the research.
Right. That's interesting. Well, going back, you know, when you were talking about changing normative behavior, and the swiftest way to do that is policy change, which, of course, brings in the government as the policy controller. Ronald Reagan famously said that the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help," which really distilled a political philosophy of government being part of the problem rather than the solution. And a lot of your work has involved an intersection with government. So how do we square that? I mean, you know, when talking about the issue of not having enemies, having policy positions. But if one of your policy positions is that government is ineffective and shouldn't be deployed, does that take you off the playing board? How does that work?
I think it does. I think we need to work with the government. It's one of the sectors that we need to employ if we're going to create real change for the better in our country. And, you know, Reagan said government is the problem.
Right.
Well, in my book, government is not the problem. We need government. We need government thinking and spending and policies. Of course, we don't want government to override us or dictate our lives, for sure. But the matter is that, you know, it's not that we should have a smaller government. It's that we should have a right-sized government.
Right.
So maybe there's too many employees in USDA. Okay, well, let's do something about it. If you look at the Social Security Administration, they don't have enough adjudicators who are working on people bringing Social Security disability claims.
Right.
And so they've got a 3-year backlog. We need to fix that.
Right.
And so really we need to think and not just act and say government is the problem.
Right. You don't just starve everything. You need to put it on a diet and get it in shape. So you're going to bulk up in some areas and not others. As a side note, I loved that Nancy Pelosi called you Republican and Mitch McConnell a Democrat. So that kind of meant that you were exactly what you needed to be right there.
Yeah.
One of the things I love about the book is how real it is, how honest it is about the mess. No money, no mission, commitment and competence. How about timing? Do you think that, like with technological development, society needs to be hit at the right time for these types of normative behavioral changes?
Oh, I do. I think you're right. I think timing is very important. And that's why we need to be opportunistic, whether you're running a company or whatever you're doing. We need to be opportunistic. You know, if the time's not right, it's very hard to make change, whether you're inside a company or whether you're trying to do something big like climate action. Mm-hmm. 5 years ago, you know, people were not tuned in this country to climate change. And today you see from the research that more and more people believe it's a serious problem. It's going to be a lot easier to make change today than it would have been back then.
Well, I guess one of the challenges with the climate change problem is everybody's on board now. Is it too late? You know, are we in a not turnaroundable situation? You know, everybody's on board because the West is on fire and the East is swamped by you know, crazy storms. Have we left it too late? I mean, that's when problems are big and need to be addressed before the suffering is felt. Getting people on board, I think, is trickier. It's harder. I think one of the things that was interesting was when you were working with AARP to influence legislation around Social Security. And it was sort of gross simplification warning in what I'm saying right now, but you leveraged public opinion to great effect there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we at AARP had really been very instrumental in getting prescription drugs into Medicare. And that was a Republican-led effort. And the mm-hmm. Democrats really didn't like it. They didn't want George W. Bush to have a win. And then the very next thing that happened was after he won the election against John Kerry, the very next day he stood up and said, I've got a bunch of social capital here, political capital, and I'm going to spend it. We're going to privatize or partially privatize Social Security. And we at AARP and many others thought that was a terrible idea.
Right.
And we set out to block it. Mm-hmm. And we did a great job. And, there's a variety of ways to think about how to fight back against government. Mm-hmm. And of course, at that point, the Democrats were in favor of what we were doing, whereas they had opposed us just the week before.
Right.
I like to say, be in the pragmatic center. Call them as you see them.
Right.
And we fought that Social Security battle. And we marshaled our forces, and we had every time President Bush would go to a new city to present his case, we had all these different protesters with signs, and we did media work, and we ran ads, and it was very, very effective. And I think it's a good. It was an example of a good campaign. It was a citizen campaign, and it worked.
Right. And that was so you were spearheading it, but it really did have I guess it's not grassroots because it didn't start there, but you were able to tap into public sentiment that already existed.
We were, but I think it did have a strong grassroots element. You know, whenever you talk to a politician and you ask a question, what you're likely to get is a soundbite.
Hmm.
You know, a really good 9-second answer.
So I want that skill.
what I used to say whenever we would train our volunteers, and grassroots is very, very important. We used to train our volunteers to ask the third question. So there's three volunteers there talking to a politician or, in a community forum. And the first question is, what are we going to do about Social Security? You get a 9-second answer. And then what you need to do is ask that second question, and the person will be more thoughtful. And then ask the third question, zero in. Because politicians are uncomfortable with that. And that's the way you get them really to think about the issue and hopefully to educate them.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's great. That's great, because then you actually get something substantive that you've run out of sound bites at that point.
And Gabriella, I want to tell you, when it comes to politicians and lobbying, we used to have a lobbyist at AARP, a woman who used to say the best lobbyists in the country are physicians because they lobby you when your clothes are off.
Well, so then what's that? That's right. So you'd think that we would have less trouble with the vaccine and social distancing then, because all the physicians are busy saying, please,
Yeah.
And also they're trusted. I think that there's an element of trust there, which is really interesting. Sort of wrapping things up, you were really ahead of your time. In 2010, Michael Porter and Mark Kramer wrote an article in the Harvard Business Review that pulled on this thread that you identified and noted that businesses need to take the lead in creating a model of shared values, that distrust in business was going to undermine competitiveness and ultimately growth, and that it was good business to do good, social value creating economic value. And certainly 10 years since that article was written, I think we've seen a growth in the interest in corporate social responsibility. And also an increasingly fractured sense of what shared value is. And so, you know, as we discussed earlier, I think there's never been a better time than now for your book to be released. And I thank you so much for spending time with us today. I enjoyed the book. I recommend that people give it a read. I'll include a link to purchase on the podcast webpage.
Gabrielle, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, all of you, the members of our audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next time right here on Up Next.